Alright, folks, I'm out of here. I feel like that last set was kind of all over the place and crazy. Like, I don't know if any of it went together, but it's all great stuff. And I guess that's why we cherish places like FFU, where I can play things that maybe you probably wouldn't hear other places in that string of things. I don't know if that's good or bad, but... yeah, we heard great stuff. Anohi just then with It Must Change. Mannequin Pussy in there with I Don't Know You. Really great new album from them. The crazy, like, hyper-pop, distorted, noisy stuff from Earth Eater, Yule, Hakushi Hasegawa, who has this crazy new album out on... Is it Ninja Tune, I think? Crazy stuff, cool. And that's the end of the show. It's WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, 91.9 FM and online WFMU.org. My name's Olivia. I'll be here next week. As always, every Monday afternoon I'm on. And I want to let you know, next weekend, if you're around, out and about, Saturday, August 3rd, here at Monty Hall, our own little space in Jersey City, 43 Montgomery Street. We're having a CD sale. Guys, if you love CDs, if you're like scooping up all the CDs deals because people are getting rid of their really good CDs, we have thousands of CDs that have not been out at any sale so far. They're going to be really good. Come on down, get a first peek at this stock that hasn't been seen yet. And yeah, so that's this Saturday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. I'm telling you, if you are really into CDs, you need them for your car, or you're just like collecting them up, that's your style, it's the place to be. See you later. Stay tuned for Mark Hurst. He's coming on right now after...
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I will be your host for the next hour here on WFMU, Freeform Station of the Nation. Live from downtown Jersey City in the great state of New Jersey. I'm so glad you have chosen to spend some time on the airwaves, on the streaming waves, on the podcast waves with me and the other listeners. I'm so happy to be here, and I'm happy to be back. I was gone last week. I want to say thanks to Brian D., the host of Currents on Saturday mornings, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, for guest hosting, sitting in the captain's chair last week, and giving us a show about misinformation and disinformation. Not one, but two interviews. Very impressive. Thank you, Brian. And if you missed that, you can find that show in the archives at WFMU.org. This evening, I've got what I find to be a fascinating but also important topic. I am calling this show Tech and the Sandwich Generation. Now, some of you may be of a certain age, and you already know what the sandwich generation refers to. But if not, this show still applies to you. Let me explain. If you are somewhere in middle age, 40s, 50s-ish maybe, maybe even down into your 30s, you may be in a position where you have some concern for the generation before and the generation after, which is to say, you may have elderly parents or in-laws or other aging relatives who you are helping to take care of or you're concerned about. At the same time, you are involved in raising kids. And a kid or kids, or perhaps you are participating in the raising of, you know, a niece or nephew or someone, some other child in that younger generation you have some responsibility for in whatever way or shape or form that comes in. And so people who are in between these two generations and have some responsibility to both are considered in the sandwich generation. Like somebody said today, it's like they're the meat, or we're the meat in between two slices of bread. So here we are, the sandwich generation. Now, if you are not responsible for both those generations, perhaps you are a member of one of those generations. Maybe you are one of the elderly friends, relatives, parents, or not even elderly. Maybe you're beyond the sandwich generation years, and you, let's say you are a little bit older, not even elderly. Or perhaps you're not quite old enough to, or you're not there yet in your life to be taking care of kids. You're perhaps a little bit on the younger side. This show applies to all of us, because I'm going to be giving tips first for what to do if you are either taking care of older relatives or perhaps you are one of those older relatives. What are some things you should know? What are some tips and some next steps that you should try or look out for, pitfalls to avoid, that sort of thing? So we're going to do aging relatives first, and then we're going to dive into the tips and pitfalls and so on. Same thing for the younger generation, for the kids. So I have these sections. If you want to check out all the links, you can go to WFMU.org and click playlists and comments, and you'll see that I've set up two sections on this playlist, one called Caring for Elders with Tech, and the second section, Caring for Kids with Tech. And if you're listening in the future to a podcast or archive version of this show, you can go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic, wfmu.fm, and you can click on the playlist link for July 29, 2024. And there we are. You can also post comments on the playlist, or if you're listening in the future, you can go back and see what the comments were for this show. So while I want to get right into caring for elders with tech, I want to say two things actually before I dive into that. And the second one is going to be a segue into caring with elders for tech. But first, before I forget, a schedule note is that next week, and I'll try to remember to say this at the end of the show as well. Next week, I'm going to be featuring an interview with John Leideker, a.k.a. Wobbly, from the band Negative Land. He's going to be the guest on Tectonic next week. And the reason for that is because next week's show is the show before the Monty Hall screening of a documentary about Negative Land. And that's something that if you're interested in Negative Land or you're intrigued, maybe you've heard me play the songs from Negative Land a couple of times over the years as outros, you should come and see this movie. It's going to be Sunday, August 11, here at Monty Hall, here at WFMU in downtown Jersey City at 43 Montgomery. The door is at 6:30 p.m. Eastern, and the film is scheduled to start at 7 p.m. This screening is going to be hosted by station manager Ken Friedman and DJ Olivia of Radio Ravioli, who you just heard just a couple of minutes ago preceding this show. So if you'd like to see Ken and Olivia, and there's a live Q&A over Zoom with the director of the movie called, the movie is called Stand By for Failure. There's going to be a live Zoom Q&A with director Ryan Worsley afterwards. As for me, I'm not sure if I can make it because I have a prior commitment. I'm going to see if I can make it, but you'll definitely get to see Ken and Olivia and over Zoom, Ryan Worsley. And again, next week's show is the show before that screening. And so I wanted to feature John Leideker from Negative Land to talk about Negative Land and their stance with respect to a lot of the trends and news in the tech industry in the last couple of years. So it's wide ranging, and I found it a very fascinating conversation. So I hope you will show up for that show next week. The other thing that I wanted to bring up that has something to do with our first section, caring for elders with tech, is I just wanted to acknowledge that while I was out last week, there was a major IT outage, which I'm sure you heard about. Maybe you experienced it yourself. But there was if you're listening in the future, this will bring you back. Last week in late July 2024, a company called CrowdStrike sent out its automatic update to Windows, Microsoft Windows installations all over the world. This is all sorts of corporations and hospitals and banks and airlines and airports and all sorts of institutions and global corporations and organizations seem to be still using Windows these days. And the CrowdStrike update was nothing unusual in that there was an automatic update. CrowdStrike sends out these updates for companies that use CrowdStrike for security, and it was just issuing a little update. Unfortunately, they chose to issue this update on a Friday. I don't know why they did that, if there was a good reason, but it sure looks like a rookie mistake. You never, never push out an automatic update or any sort of upgrade on a Friday just in case you bring down the whole world. And it's a lot harder to get people into the office on a weekend to do damage control. But in fact, that's exactly what happened. There was one line in the automatic update was erroneous. There was a bug. And that brought down the Windows installations. I'm sure you heard no end of news coverage about this. This affected my own travel. Well, not my travel personally, but I was getting together with some family out of state, And a number of my family members who were traveling in from out of state were affected in that they were unable to fly. And so they had to embark on long car journeys because the airline they happened to be flying on, Delta Airlines, was totally shut down. And even several days into it, there seemed to be no relief in sight. I didn't check today. I'm not sure if it's all resolved, but I mean, it took several days of the bad news, and it was still happening. I mean, people were camped out at one place I heard was Atlanta Airport. People were sleeping on the floors, and when you call Delta Airlines on the 1-800 number, no one picked up. There was just an automated message apparently that said, "Yeah, we can't help you. Sorry." And that was pretty much it. And click. And so, how this relates to caring with aging relatives with tech. One of the lessons around CrowdStrike, one of the things that this should be a wake-up call for people, is that you can't count on anything in the cloud being available to you when you want it. Okay, there is no guarantee if you have data or services that you rely on somewhere out in the cloud on the internet, there is no guarantee that it's going to be up and functioning and available at the moment when you need it. In fact, anything out there can go down at a moment's notice and can stay down for several days, just as this CrowdStrike event reminded us. And by the way, this was not a hacking incident. This was not a malicious intrusion of systems. This was just a simple automatic update that had a bug in the code. If it had been a hacking incident, that's another risk that we are running all of the time. So you could say, well, I'm sure CrowdStrike has learned its lesson and they're not going to deploy updates on Fridays anymore and they're going to double check the sanity of their code. There's still the specter of hackers and cybercrime and malicious intent to bring down systems that we're going to be facing at all times from now on. So if you have any data out there that is critical to you to be able to access any kind of service that you need, just know that it can be taken down at any time from now on with no notice and can stay down for several days, as I said. So how this relates to elder care is that if you read up on what people suggest for aging relatives, could be parents, or some other relative, what they tell you is to start working on digital asset management. And I'm gonna play you an excerpt from a past interview in a moment about how this relates to the CrowdStrike issue and the lesson here that you cannot count on things being available out on the internet. I'm going to get to that. The first thing I want to cover, though, is speaking of malicious intent and hackers and so on, I want to say a word about scams, because digital scams are proliferating. We're seeing many more types of scams coming, especially targeting aging and elderly individuals. And there are two lessons. Okay, I'm gonna list these out to you. Two lessons. And really, this is for people of any age, but especially if you have aging relatives, you want to impart a couple of tips for avoiding scams. There are two things. First of all, when an institution calls or claims to call them, when they pick up the phone and it says, "Hello, John," or whatever their name is, "this is your bank," or "Hello, John, this is your insurance company," or "Hello, John, this is," you know, name the company or organization or institution that they have a relationship with. And the person on the other end says, "Please send me your," or "please read out to me your credit card number. Please read out to me your social security number. We simply need this to verify your identity, or we need to verify some charges, or we just need to take care of this small detail. If you just give me your information, we'll take care of it from here." Tell your aging relative, first of all, never, never give your personal identifying information like credit card, social security, none of that, to someone on an incoming phone call. Even if they seem very legitimate and persuasive that they are actually from the bank or the insurance company, no. What you tell them is, I will call you back, and you hang up the phone, and then you call back. You call the bank or insurance company at their 1-800 number or whatever their customer service number is, and then you say, now I'm ready to answer your questions, because you know this is the right place. That's one easy tip. The other thing that I wanted to pass along is the other kind of scam is when someone comes, again, it's an incoming phone call, but this time they're not impersonating a bank or insurance company or health, you know, hospital chain or whatever. This is the scam where they're impersonating an individual in the family. And it's often for aging relatives or who are grandparents, it's often a grandkid. And they'll say, oh, grandma, I'm in some trouble. I need you to wire me $500 or $5,000 very quickly. I can't give you any details right now because I'm really in trouble. I don't have very much time, but I need you to wire the money to the following number or send it via Venmo or whatever. And the grandmother is of course beside herself that this voice, which she's going to believe is her grandson, is telling her that the grandson is in trouble, and so she wants to send the money, and you know where that all leads. Once again, you have to call the kid back, or if they, for some reason, say, oh, no, this is from a different, my phone was destroyed, you can't call me back, then what you say is, can you tell me, you know, what was the name of your pet in fifth grade? Or, you know, just ask a security question, and maybe establish with your relatives beforehand what that security question is going to be, so that if an incoming call comes in from a relative, they can ask that and see if it's actually the real person or if it's an imposter. Okay, so those are probably the two most important tips against scams. Now, I want to get to digital asset management. Digital asset management, this is apart from, let's say that you have fully protected your aging relatives against scams and so on. This is the part where the aging relative needs to have some guidance about what to do with all of their digital assets. That could be passwords, documents, photos, you know, anything digital that they want to hold on to, and especially that they may want to impart to the next generation, much like their physical assets that might be named in a will. What happens after they pass? What happens to these assets? They want to have this plan already made. So what is the strategy for digital asset management? And there's one tip that I want to start off with, and this comes from a previous show. You can see it listed on the playlist. It comes from my August 17, 2020 show with Elaine Casket. Yes, that is her last name, Casket, author of the book All the Ghosts in the Machine. And I asked her about digital asset management and what are some of the tips. And she had one tip right away, and this is what she said.
If there's stuff that is meaningful to you, if there's photos that you want to pass on to future generations, print them out right now. Because basically, it's safer to assume that for anything that is password protected, whether that's your device or whether that's an account or whether that's both, you know, that it's likelier that your estate, that your loved ones are not going to be able to get hold of that than it is that they are. We make these pre-digital era assumptions thinking, oh, well, they're my family, they're my next of kin, they're my spouse or whatever, so I'm sure they'll be able to have access to that. No, that doesn't automatically happen. But I mean, it is no easy matter, for example, to obtain a bunch of family photographs that somebody's stored in their iCloud, for example, if you are not the owner of that account. I periodically curate, which is a useful exercise in an era when we take literally thousands of photographs, to curate those photographs that are most important to us or that commemorate a special event. And I put them in books, and I give a book to my daughter, and I give a book to somebody else. There's a couple copies of it. I have every faith that my descendants will have a better chance of accessing that than anything I post on social media or anywhere else online today. Hardware fails, data migrates and is lost, companies fail and lock up the stores, and the bailiffs come along and take away the servers. By what mechanism is my granddaughter or my great-grandson going to access something that I post on Instagram today? By no mechanism.
Okay, so again, that was Elaine Casket, author of All the Ghosts in the Machine, speaking to me on the August 17, 2020 Tectonic. That was almost 4 years ago, and I still stand by that advice. In fact, I'd say it's even more relevant in light of the CrowdStrike Microsoft issues from last week, which, again, reminded us that anything online can go down for several days, or maybe even indefinitely, if it's a ransomware attack or hackers hit the data, who knows what's going to happen to it. So listen to what Elaine Casket was saying. If you have anything that you really want to guarantee that you can hold on to, print it out. Again, that's if it's something you can print out. For instance, videos you won't be able to print out, but photos. If there are photos that are really important to you, you can make nice little photo books. There are various services online that'll print these out, and then you'll have them in hand as physical objects that will not be susceptible to what can happen to digital data. Similarly, if there are written documents that you want to make sure that you have on hand, print it out. Let's say there's a will. Don't just have the will in some digital depository somewhere. You want to also have a printed copy just in case the digital depository goes down. All right, so with that said, let's say that you have taken that to heart. Your aging relatives have printed out the photos and the will and other documents that are really important to them. What are some other things that you have to think about in digital asset management? First of all, if they have a surveillance phone, make sure, this is a pretty easy tip, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention it. Make sure you write down the PIN, the four-digit code or the six-digit code to unlock the phone. Because if something happens to your relative and they have a lot of data on their phone, you want to be able to get onto the phone. So make sure you get the surveillance phone PIN. There are a bunch of, beyond the PIN, there are a bunch of other little access points to social media services and other platforms, credentials like passwords and maybe the answers to security questions. Those you may want to print out, or you may want to just have on hand somewhere. Somehow make sure that you go through the important accounts that you want to get to if and when this person passes, bank accounts, maybe an email account, if they have to continue using a social media account and that's important to you, what are the credentials to log into these services in their absence? That's another thing to take a look at. Now, there are these companies called digital asset management companies that promise to gather and hold on to this information for you. So you can think about a whole logging into your account with one of these companies, and you'll see a whole portfolio of accounts at various financial institutions and social media and e-commerce, and you have all of the usernames, passwords, security questions all laid out nicely for you that you can access, and they guarantee they're going to keep it backed up and have it available to you for if and when you need access to it after the relative dies, or even if they don't die and if they're sick for a while, you can still get access to it. It's an interesting idea, and there are a number of companies out there promising basically the same thing, that they will hold on to these digital assets and act as the stewards of them until such time as you need access to them. However, there is a risk to digital asset management companies. This came up on another recent episode, or more recent than the 2021. This was from August 28, 2023. So just not quite a year ago, I spoke with Tamara Neese, who wrote a book called Death Glitch about the tech industry and how it deals with the issue of death. And digital asset management came up quite a bit. And I asked Tamara what she thought about these digital asset management companies. And I thought her response was really important. So here's what she said, again, from the August 28, 2023 show.
It's very hard to predict which of these companies would actually be around long enough to oversee the transfer of digital assets from one generation to the next, or even what that would really mean. Because the fundamental problem is that not only are the startups usually short-lived, and so the likelihood of them actually being able to transfer all of your digital stuff to your, you know, kids or grandkids is pretty unlikely. But even the things that they're attempting to transfer may not survive. And so thinking about how many platforms are also fairly precarious, or websites, or, you know, various digital belongings that people have, you know, as people think about things like PayPal, certainly, or just, you know, banking information. I mean, that is stuff that really should be managed by, you know, an estate planning attorney, somebody who actually knows what they're doing, and probably not a startup.
Okay, and probably not a startup, Tamara says. Again, that was Tamara Neese, author of the book Death Glitch, talking to me on the August 28, 2023 Tectonic. And as you heard her say, a lot of these companies are startups. And what do we know about startups? Is that they could go away. And again, this doesn't have to be a CrowdStrike issue. It doesn't have to be a hacker, ransomware, malicious hacking, any of that. Just in the normal course of their operations, startups tend to go under, sometimes unexpectedly, and everything that they were holding on to goes with them. And so you, once again, you cannot count on anything in the cloud being available to you when you need it. You may still choose to use one of these digital asset management companies. Maybe it has a convenience factor for you, and you know, maybe that's one part of your strategy. You should know that they're out there. But if there's anything that you definitely need to have access to at all times, guaranteed, then what I would recommend that you do is get it locally. Either print it out if you can, or if you can't print it out or you want to make an additional copy, have it on some local drive or even a USB thumb drive that's local to you, so that if the startup goes under, you still have access to it. Now, there's one more thing about digital asset management, and that is that apart from passwords and bank accounts and so on like that, there is a class of companies that unfortunately will probably last until the final day of the internet, whenever that's going to be. And these are the big tech toxic sludge factories. These are companies like Facebook Meta and Google Alphabet, all of these toxic Silicon Valley giants. These have a very small chance of going down. They may at some point, of course, nothing is guaranteed, but of all the companies out there, these are the ones that are best protected and least likely to go down. So if you have data on one of those, you probably are going to want to have a strategy for how to access that data. If your aging relative has an account, let's say, on Google, and has Google Docs, Google Drive, Google Sheets, who knows what all they have, you're going to want to get their credentials so that you can log into that. Of course, I would prefer that you downloaded all of that locally, but companies like Google, companies like Apple for the access to someone's iCloud account, and certainly Facebook Meta, if the relative really wants to maintain their account there, you should have some access to their account. In the case of Facebook in particular, one last detail, there is something called memorialization, where you can sign up to be a legacy contact. that will be able to flip a switch, basically, if the relative passes, and turn their Facebook page into a memorial so that it's still active, but it's something that indicates that they're no longer alive and acts as an online memorial on Facebook. By the way, similarly, Apple and Google allow you to identify what they call legacy contacts, so that even if you don't have the password for your past relative, you can still get access to their account after they die. So that's just another way to get access in that event. So if there are big tech services that have data that's really important for you to access afterwards, and you can't download it or somehow are unable to download it ahead of time, you can set yourself up as a legacy contact. Of course, I would say it's best to get off of Google, don't use Facebook, get off of Facebook, but we're talking about your relationship to your relatives, and that may be very difficult to dictate to them what they should do with their data and their access. So if you have to deal with an aging relative who has accounts on those services, set yourself up as a legacy contact. With that said, as I started with in this section, you have to think about what can you print out and what can you back up locally. And the last thing I'll say in this elder care section is that there's a concept called the 3-2-1 backup, which might be helpful to you. 3-2-1 backup means you keep three copies of the data. One is the primary copy, and then there are two copies as backups, so three copies. That gives you three chances for the data to be available. Two is you have copies on two different types of storage media. So one can be in the cloud, and then one should be on, let's say, a USB drive or a thumb drive or something else, something other than the cloud. That's two. Two is two different media types. And then one is place one of those copies offsite, which is to say, not co-located with all of the other data. Maybe you have another relative's house, or you have a storage facility, or you have a lockbox somewhere. Store the physical media, the USB hard drive, offsite somewhere. So if your own home or your relative's home gets hit with a flood or a fire or something, that additional copy is still available. So that's the 3-2-1 backup. So whether you are printing things out, or you are storing things digitally, but you want to store them locally, think of the 3-2-1 backup as a way to ensure that you have access to that important information. And if there is a CrowdStrike issue or a hacking attack in the future, you will still have at least one offline, offsite backup of the data that's important to you. And maybe even it'll be printed out on paper, which the hackers are going to have a whole lot of trouble getting at and taking away from you. Okay, so those are the tips for elder care. First, a couple of suggestions for priming them against recent scams, and the other is how to deal with digital asset management. By the way, if you want to post your own suggestions, or if you have questions for other listeners, it's going to be hard for me to answer the comment board right now, but you can go to the comment board at wfmu.org, click playlists and comments, and there's a bunch of comments there. We are going to get to caring for kids with tech here in a moment on Tectonic on WFMU. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mike. What is my name? My name is Mark Hurst. I am your host, and I'll remain your host for the next 22 minutes. And then Dave Mandel, who you can't handle, will come in with his show, It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show. Tonight, we're going through what I'm calling the sandwich generation with tech. We talked about elder care, the generation ahead of us, and now let's talk about kids, the generation to follow us. There's a bunch of links on the playlist at WFMU.org. Click playlists and comments. And let me just say that the news for kids online is not great. There's been a bunch of writing, a bunch of research, and a bunch of books about the research that have been coming out in the last couple of years. And if you're raising a kid in this tech-saturated society, I feel your pain. I mean, I've got a teenage boy, DJ Paradox, and I have lived this for the last several years. It's not easy. There's no perfect way to do it. And all I'm going to do is just point you to some resources so you can make your own choices. I'm hardly an expert myself, but I have found some interesting takes on what's happening with kids in tech. One of the main books that came out that's gotten a lot of attention in the last few months is a book called The Anxious Generation. It's written by Jonathan Haidt, who's an NYU professor here in New York. And what Haidt does is he looks at the research that is showing some disturbing trends of mental health issues on the rise in young tech users, which is to say young people in the U.S., teenage and preteen. And the rate of depression and hopelessness, and especially in teen girls, self-harm and suicidal ideation, these have all been documented, and they all started a distinct rise when iPhones and social media services really got popular around 2010 or so. And over the last 10 to 14 years, let's say, the rates of all of these horrible things have gone up and up and up. And you have complaints from parents and you have complaints from teachers. And there just seems to be a nationwide epidemic of really negative effects caused by the big tech companies that are allowing or even enabling the predatory behavior visited upon these young users. And of course, the big tech companies, Facebook primary among them, allows this and enables it because it leads to profit. And Mark Zuckerberg is on record in leaked documents, having been briefed on the negative effects, saying, no, let's keep doing it. I mean, growth at any cost, guys, come on, let's go. And so and it's not just Facebook. There are plenty of other companies that are preying on young users. And so Jonathan Haidt writes this book saying, look at these documented rates of mental health issues experienced by young people, and look how it corresponds with the rise of social media and surveillance phones. And so what are we going to do about it? Now, of course, there were some counterpoints, some people criticizing the book saying, well, correlation does not equal causation. In other words, yes, kids are suffering greater mental health issues. We can agree with that. But you can't really point the finger at Silicon Valley because maybe it's the economy, or maybe it was COVID, or maybe it's these other things. And Haidt deals with each one of these criticisms in turn and says, look, all of the signs point to digital technology being net-net a harmful force for young users. Yes, there are ways to use it in positive ways. There are some gains that kids can make from digital devices. But overall, there are these mental health issues that are really crying out for some sort of solution, or at least to be addressed in some way. So Jonathan Haidt, and I'm skipping over all the research. I'm trying to get to the tips here. Jonathan Haidt has several suggestions for how to deal with kids and tech if you're raising kids. Number one, and this is all on the playlist at WFMU.org if you want to follow along. I put in a link to a post in his own newsletter from January 18, 2024. Number one, no smartphone before high school. That is to say, do not give a kid a surveillance phone or a surveillance tablet or surveillance pad before high school. if they're in middle school, or for heaven's sake, if they're in elementary school, I've seen preschool kids walking around with these surveillance devices. If they're in middle school or earlier, you give them a flip phone. And parents say, well, how am I going to know if Timmy is all right? How am I going to know if when Timmy is on the bus coming home? How am I going to know? You give Timmy a flip phone. That's what you do. And by the way, flip phones can text. My own DJ Paradox had a flip phone until, I don't know how old he was. He was the, as he said in a previous interview, he was on the show, he was the last kid in his grade to go from a flip phone to a full surveillance phone. No surveillance phones before high school. Okay, that's number one. Number two, no social media at all before age 16. And this is a tough one because people will say, well, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, they all have this age minimum. It's federally mandated, by the way, age 13 and up. And I've covered on the show before that the social media sludge factories know, they know that they have so many users who are coming on and signing on who are 8, who are 10, you know, they're clearly under 13 years old, and they do nothing to stop it because, again, growth at any cost. At any cost, even at the cost of the harm, direct harm towards these young users, they do not care. They care only for growth. And so when people say, well, if we could only enforce 13 above, no. Jonathan Haidt is saying 16, even stricter, make it 16 and above. And I mean, it's not going to be enforced. Even the 13 age minimum is not going to be enforced anytime soon. So it's going to be up to parents to decide. Timmy is not going to have a social media account until 16. And yes, when they're 16 and 17 and 18, they start to make their own decisions. They start to get more responsible. And maybe there are some gains to having some social activity on social media. If they are mature enough to get themselves away from all the harms. But when they are 12, they should not, and they're 13, they should not be on TikTok. They should not be on Facebook, not be on Instagram. They should not be on Snapchat. All of those should be totally, the parents should prevent them from accessing or even having the apps on their surveillance phone, which they shouldn't have until high school anyway. Okay, so number one, no surveillance phone before high school. Number two, no social media before age 16. And then three, talking about the schools themselves, let's have phone-free schools. Phone-free schools, which is to say when kids get to school, they are forced by the school, by school policy, to put their phone in their locker or in one of these, they're called Yonder pouches, and I think there's a number of types, but these pouches that are locked at the beginning of the day and they're only unlocked at the end of the day when the kid can retrieve the phone. The good news on that point, by the way, is that as Chalkbeat reported just a couple weeks ago on July 17, New York City is planning to institute a ban on all cell phones at school in February of next year, 2025. And again, it's a plan. It's only been announced as a plan. It's not been instituted yet. But fingers crossed that this could actually happen. So New York City could be leading the pack here and actually executing number three of Jonathan Haidt's recommendations: phone-free schools. Okay, and then number four, Jonathan Haidt writes a lot about play, the importance of free play and independence. And here he talked on the Persuasion podcast back in March about the idea of play. And he said that, quote, what I call the phone-based childhood blocks many developmental pathways. The purpose of childhood is to give the animal time to wire up its brain and learn behaviors that will need in adulthood. And what is it that children need to do to wire up? Play. All mammals play, and play is essential. For example, if you deprive baby rhesus monkeys or mice or any animals of play, they don't develop proper social skills. They're much more anxious for the rest of their lives. They don't explore as much. And of course, Haidt's book is called The Anxious Generation. So he's making the case that the absence of play and is causing problems. We are replacing play and independence with these screens in which kids are mesmerized, hypnotized by these toxic sludge factories in Silicon Valley, growth that are growth at any cost, and are perfectly willing to visit all manner of harms, mental health harms, and others on these kids in order to gain a little more engagement, in order to engage and increase the engagement and monetize that. And so what happens is the kids are both increasing in their anxiety, and in some cases their self-harm, as I said before, and they're losing the opportunity of developing independence by having play. And the way to play is not to play some glorified slot machine, one of these very popular apps that the kids are always on their surveillance phones. That's not real play. What real play is putting the screen down and interacting with other people. It could be playing outside, or it could be it doesn't have to be outside. Just put down the screen. Just turn off the access to Silicon Valley, or rather prevent Silicon Valley's access to the kids' lives. And then good things start to happen. Okay, those are Jonathan Haidt's four suggestions. I wanted to also bring up this opinion piece in the New York Times from April 10, 2024. It's called "Get Tech Out of the Classroom Before It's Too Late," written by Jessica Gross. Jessica writes, "The bad guys, as I see it, are tech companies. One way or another, we've allowed big tech's tentacles into absolutely every aspect of our children's education with very little oversight and no real proof that their devices or programs improve educational outcomes." So here, what this op-ed is saying is, not only should we get phones out of school, we should probably think about getting Google Classroom out of school. Let's get Silicon Valley and big tech entirely out of classrooms until and unless they can show real necessity, real improvement in kids' academic performance. Just delete it. Just get it out. Get it out of the classroom entirely. Gross continues, "We have let tech companies and their products set the terms of the argument about what education should be, and too many people, myself included, didn't initially realize it. Companies never had to prove that devices or software help students learn before these devices had wormed their way into America's public schools, and now the onus is on parents to marshal arguments about the detriments of tech in schools." And once again, as we see from Jonathan Haidt, he's saying no smartphones until high school and no social media until age 16. Who's going to enforce that? It can only be the parents, because schools are not going to be able to do that, and the government has not done very much to enforce kids' protection against the predators in Silicon Valley. And so it's up to parents and guardians and friends and the whole community surrounding the kids to protect them. And that puts responsibility on us, the sandwich generation, to do something about keeping kids free as much as possible, free from the predation of Silicon Valley and big tech. There was one comment on that New York Times op-ed that I wanted to share. I didn't get the person's name, but here's what they wrote. "I'm a college professor, and I can tell you what I see in this generation of students. They don't talk to each other. They stare at their phones. They think YouTube is a college-level source. They can't write by hand or take notes or even read very well. It's appalling. I've been teaching for almost 19 years, and what has happened over the last 10 years is nothing short of criminal. Education has sold its soul to big tech, and now we are reaping the consequences." It's like something I would have written if I had been a college professor for 19 years. I mean, education has sold its soul to big tech, and now we're reaping the consequences. That is, that's a very tectonic kind of thought, don't you think? And it is consistent with what I have heard and what I've read from other professors and teachers, in that the students of today are noticeably less able to read than previous generations. And this is not just old guy yelling at the clouds, you know, things used to be better in the old days. That's not this. These are experienced teachers who are saying, I have taught several generations of students, and this one that we're teaching now is distinctly different. They are distinctly less skilled. They have less attention span. They have less ability with words. They have less capacity to interpret a multi-paragraph section of a reading. And some of these are at top schools, supposedly top schools at the Ivy League, and they're saying, you know, the Scarlet Letter is too advanced for some of these students. I think that was a Harvard professor who wrote that one. So, what are we supposed to do with that? This is a challenge for all of us in the sandwich generation and older to think about how we are going to take steps to encourage school-age kids of this following generation to free themselves somehow, to help free themselves from Silicon Valley. There's one other piece I want to read, and having to do with teaching and kids using these technologies, because that New York Times op-ed, it mentioned some of the technologies that are hurting education, but it doesn't mention ChatGPT. And if you go to the playlist at WFMU.org, there is a little multi-post story, an anecdote from someone called Still Orange D. I believe it was on Blue Sky, I'm not sure. And this individual claims to be a teacher. Here's what they said. Weird interaction with a student this week. They kept coming up with weird, quote-unquote, facts, such as Greek is actually a combination of four other languages. And these facts, quote-unquote, left me baffled. I said to the student, let's look this stuff up together. And they said, okay, I'll open a search bar. And they opened ChatGPT. And I was like, this is not a search bar. And they said, yes, it is. You can search for anything in here. Well, the thing that made me feel crazy is every kid that's using this, ChatGPT, as a browser is getting new, bespoke, false facts, quote-unquote facts. This isn't like a widespread misconception about such and such a topic that stems from how it's taught in schools. No, each individual kid is now hooked into a nonsense machine. And with this nonsense machine, each child is getting unique, wrong facts that they are sure are correct because they did what we told them to do. They looked it up. They got it from somewhere online. It's something they think they learned. And goes on to say, this is so rough. The teacher feels crushed because what are they going to do when ChatGPT is now seen by this next generation of students as a legitimate authority when actually it is a nonsense machine? So, friends, we've got our work cut out for us, whether we are taking care of aging relatives and friends or we're taking care of kids younger than us. We need to help them be protected against the growth at any cost ideology from Silicon Valley and big tech that wants to harm them, because harming these people, it makes money for these companies, and they need to keep growing because their ideology is eternal growth. And I, for one, want to do what I can to raise awareness, to hopefully give you a couple of tips so that you can go out there and help people free themselves and maybe find a way to use technology in a positive way and not be harmed by it. That's about all the time I have this evening. You've been listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. And I want you to stay tuned for Dave Mandel and his show, It's Complicated. I got a song for you with some advice. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. Have a great week.
Hey there, friends, and welcome to another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. This show comes to you every Monday evening at this time, 7 p.m., following hot on the heels of Mark Hurst and Tectonic. Welcome. Great to see you all out there. Sorta. I have a bunch of Swedish music to play this week. That's just the way things go sometimes. But, as a matter of fact, the track I'm going to open the show with right now is not from Sweden at all. In fact, it's from a Russian band, a Moscow-based band called Sanskrit Canon. And what can I tell you about this? This is a track from a self-titled album that was released last year. That's 2023, if you're keeping score. And there's not much information. I haven't found much information about this group out there, but they are on Bandcamp. There's some information there, and also their records are available. A few, I think they have maybe three, available on Bandcamp. So check them out. Sanskrit Canon from Moscow.